Irreverent, entertaining, cool. You're listening to LA Talk Radio.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polacek, only on LA Talk Radio.
Welcome to another edition of Answers for the Family. I'm your host, Alan Cardoza, and my co-host, Dr. Matt Polacek, is still on vacation, but he will be back next week, which is something I'm really looking forward to. Now, for those of you that have been listening, sending in questions and comments, I want to take this time to really thank you. It is such a great part of the show, and it is much appreciated, so keep it up. And please continue to spread the word that every Monday from 11 a.m. to noon Pacific time, this show will bring you special guests that can inspire, educate, and in some cases entertain while bringing answers and options to making your life happier, healthier, and more successful. Now, this show will address a lot of subjects. It will address issues such as locating a runaway teen, family crisis intervention, building self-esteem, dealing with addictions, and so much more. We will introduce you to talented authors and new innovations in the areas of health, security, and fun for you and your family. Now, with our experience working with families in crisis, we've been fortunate to meet and work with some of the top professionals in many of the helping fields who are all working to make this world a better place for all of us. Now, our topic today, it's an area that it's all over the news. I mean, it's something that we really all need to be paying attention to, and that has to do with addiction. And we're going to be focusing on kicking alcohol and drug addiction. Now, according to the National Institute on Drug Abuse, from 2001 to 2014, deaths involving heroin increased by sixfold. I mean, think about that for a minute. Also, deaths involving benzodiazepines increased fivefold. Deaths involving prescription opiate pain relievers show a 3.4-fold increase, and cocaine deaths increased by 42% over the same period. And that's the same National Institute estimates that the cost for this, the cost to our nation that are related to either crime, lost work, and the healthcare costs are staggering. Now, this particular statistic also takes in tobacco, but the abuse of tobacco, alcohol, and illicit drugs is costing our nation more than $700 billion annually. And, you know, this is broken down, but I mean, really, alcohol from healthcare costs, it's estimated at $25 billion. And overall, when you take in productivity, crime and such is $224 billion. For illicit drugs, it is estimated that the overall cost is $193 billion. Now, what do we do about it? Well, according to Psychology Today, naltrexone is an opiate antagonist that has been approved by the FDA for the treatment of narcotic drug and alcohol dependency since the mid-90s. Now, it's a drug that blocks the opiate receptors in the brain and prevents opiate drugs like heroin from binding to the receptors, the result of which is the patient does not experience a high when using these substances. Now, our guest today to discuss this is Kenneth Coricio, who is the owner and chief operating officer of Inland Detox Incorporated. It's a residential, subacute, non-medical drug and alcohol detox facility serving those in need of executive-level alcohol and drug detoxification. They're located on 8 acres in the Temecula Valley, and the detox program is a starting point towards lifelong sobriety. Kenneth, welcome to Answers for the Family.
Thank you for having me.
Well, it is great to have you on. it's certainly a topic that we are all seeing. I mean, you know, because of the fact that we're starting off a new year, we've seen a lot of things out there in the news, some of which is going back and showing which celebrities have died, and many of which, unfortunately, have been due to drug overdose. So it's something that is fresh in our mind and something that unfortunately, we're all seeing, you know, every day. So tell us a little bit about, I mean, how you see the opiate epidemic and how it's manifesting itself in the lives of Americans today.
I see the opiate epidemic in a much different way than many people might see it. I'm not sure how people might perceive it, but from what I understand, a lot of people think it's just you know, a substance of abuse now. People will do whatever they can to get their hands on it. But I see it differently. I see young people who have sports injuries. I see people that are middle-aged getting into car accidents. And instead of, you know, just getting through their work, they just continue to get prescribed opiate medication, and then they eventually get hooked on it. And when they're cut off, they go to the street for illicit drugs such as heroin or anything else they can get their hands on. So a lot of other people see is it's not just affecting people that are stereotypical drug abusers, youth or people that are poor. It's hitting every layer of society, people from every economic bracket, and the use of it is pervasive. It's pervasive. It's being sold in schools in pill form. It's being sold in the street. And unfortunately, the prescription variety of, let's just call them opiate or heroin-like drugs, is far more expensive than the illicit version heroin. So if you cannot get it from a doctor, if you cannot get it prescribed, then many of these people who have these addictions will just go to the street and get it.
And when they go to the street, I mean, obviously, they're not getting something that is measured correctly. It's not something that a physician or a psychiatrist has felt that is the adequate amount for that particular person. Share a little bit about that. I mean, you know, why is it that this is happening, and what can we be doing about it?
Well, it's happening because, frankly, there's no other way to deal with this. I don't think the country has come to grips with how to really tackle this problem. People can prescribe pain medication in large doses. Like I said, when they go to the street, they can buy it in pill form, but it's far too expensive. So oftentimes they'll resort to taking heroin. And like you said, it's not pure. You don't know what's in it, and it could be laced with other drugs to increase the potency of a weaker form of heroin, something like fentanyl, which in a very small dose is something that is lethal. So the problem that you have is you've got young people or middle-aged people that are addicted to prescription pain medication. They go to the street, they don't know what to do with it, and they're entering a different, they're creating different problems for themselves, or entering different problems for themselves. So the behavior gets more criminal, they start to get into more problems, this exacerbates drug use. It's really just an unfortunate, never-ending cycle for a lot of people.
You know, I was discussing this topic as I was reading up on it. I was at the gym, and a woman that I speak to from time to time there told me just a story that was heartbreaking, and especially as I was, you know, it was over the holidays, and we'd been talking about some very positive things, and she asked about the show, and she shared with me something I didn't know, and she said that her son, her adult son, had passed away from a drug overdose, and it's very close to what it is you're describing. And what she described was the fact that he had been in a car accident. He had a good job. I mean, he was working in corporate America, but he was in a car accident, and he was taking pain medication, and that after he was supposedly healed, insurance company said, okay, we're not going to be paying for this any longer. And he said that, or she says that the pain came back. And as you're saying, he went out and he found inexpensive drugs on the street to continue to deal with the pain. And for, we don't know exactly why, or she said she doesn't know exactly why, but he ended up overdosing. And again, we don't know if it's because it was laced with something else or if he took too much of it. But is this the example that you're referring to?
Yeah, it's absolutely one of them. I mean, it's terrible. It's like I said in the beginning, this is not just about the common conception that people have of a drug addict or drug addiction. It's not. The opiate epidemic is real. It's no longer just affecting people that are poor, living in inner cities. It's something that's affecting people of every walk of life. And you have to ask yourself why. And the only conclusion I come to is potentially that it's overprescribed. Mm-hmm. Potentially that when people are addicted to it, one of the problems that they run into, like you're describing, is that insurance companies will stop paying for it after a period of time. Perhaps the people aren't being monitored well enough. Increasing, when they voluntarily increase their own dosages, no one really knows. So it's something that just, not very closely monitored. Maybe that is one of the ways that this can change, is if when opiate medications are prescribed, the patient is more closely monitored. What does that really mean? It mm-hmm. means higher cost. And unfortunately, that's another problem with the drug and alcohol treatment industry. The problem is access. Honestly is. If you don't have good insurance, many people are turned away from it.
Well, let's talk a little bit about some of the cutting edge things that you're doing or that the industry is doing to try to fight this. And one of the things is the naltrexone. Tell us a little bit about naltrexone.
Naltrexone is an opiate blocker. It's been around for a very long time. FDA approved in pill form since the 90s. It goes under the brand name Vivitrol when it's injected. And lately we've seen multiple people, multiple parties, multiple providers offer something called a naltrexone pellet, which is they take naltrexone, they send it to a compounding pharmacy, which puts it into a pellet form, and it's slowly released over the span of 3 months to 12 months, and it can block the effects of opiate and alcohol. So what does that really mean? Does it mean it's a cure? Absolutely not. It really doesn't address cravings all that well. Frankly, if you take it, it just makes the feelings of opiates or alcohol just feel dulled. So you may feel fatigued, tired, but you're not going to get the same pleasurable effects that you would if it wasn't in your system. It is one can do in conjunction with many others. So it's not a magic bullet, but it's something that's effective. One of the problems that people are having is that the pellet, which is long-lasting, may not be covered by insurance. Also, well, injectable is very expensive. And lastly, the problem with the naltrexone pill is that it only lasts for a day. So,
well, that's exactly what I was going to ask. When you said long-lasting, define long-lasting. If somebody is, and I've heard the term, if they've had it implanted.
It will be effective for 3 months to a year, depending on the instructions that a physician gives to a compounding pharmacy. So it can last a very long time. But one of the problems that people have had in the past with naltrexone is the voluntary consumption of it on the part of the patient. So if you're dealing with addiction, which is not just a physical problem, it's also an emotional, psychological, sure, spiritual problem, you know, just dealing with the physical aspect of it isn't going to stop you from wanting to take drugs and alcohol. So a 1 day or a half-life of 12 hours or 24 hours, you know, it's not good enough to help people solve their problem. So looking for things that are going to last longer, like the injection or the pellet. The injection lasts for 30 days. Those are things that can help people. And if you can get people to be sober for a year, let's just say, if you can help someone get to that year mark, they've got a really good shot at putting the problem behind them. So if you go back and see a doctor once every 30 days in conjunction with psychotherapy, you've got a much better shot at remaining sober long term than if you were to try and do it on your own or take a pill that lasts for 24 hours.
Yeah, I mean,
naltrexone, something that's underutilized. It's something that can help people. It's not for everybody, but I do want to stress it's not a magic bullet. It's not a cure. It's just one thing that can help people get over that hump that may be underutilized.
Now, I've heard from some that it is used in some jail or prison systems. That seems like it makes perfect sense to me. So share with our listeners, I mean, if it is being used, how it's being used that way. And, I mean, it seems like a no-brainer when you are in a position to where you have that kind of leverage. You know, if you have the kind of leverage of, you know, essentially you're not getting out of here, you know, until you or it's a choice, you know, OK, you can do 5 years for the crime that you committed, or you can take this and be out of here, you know, in a year or in 6 months and take it before you leave so that there's another 6 months or a year that this drug will be operating in your system. Is this being done? And if not, why?
I've heard that this is actually happening. I read an article a little while ago. I believe the title was "The $1,000 Shot That Can End Addiction" being used in America's prison system. And they were talking about Vivitrol. They're using it, from what I understand, in some locations, not everywhere.
Mm-hmm.
They're using Vivitrol as a means to curb heroin addiction in jails and prisons.
Right.
So is it something that they're using as a carrot and stick? Take this and we'll let you out earlier. I really don't know. All I can say is that I think it's promising that America's prisons and jails are looking for ways to help end addiction. But I also think it's sad. And the reason why is this. Jails shouldn't be places where we try and heal people from addiction. We should try and do that before they get there. And if this was more open to the public, regular access was better, perhaps not as many people would have to detox in jail or prison.
That makes perfect sense. and unfortunately, we have a government that doesn't seem to work real well in regards to preventative. They seem to focus more after the fact rather than before. But again, I completely agree with you. But at the same time, I mean, it seems like it would really make a lot of sense to at least start, and, you know, doing it in those settings. But I think there's another component that would make a lot of sense also, and that is for them to have to check in with programs like yours, so that if we have a situation to where rather than checking in with, like, say, a probation officer, okay, that's great, you're checking in with a probation officer, but why not have them to where they have to check in, you know, with a program like yours, so that there is the follow-up, not just taking the pill, but all of the other things that are done from a psychological standpoint to make sure that they don't, fall off the wagon, so to speak.
I totally get it. I think one of the problems historically has been that funding for programs like that. So we'll talk about the difference between Medicare, Medi-Cal rates, and private insurance rates. One pays out more, and the other pays out very, very little. And the unfortunate reality of treatment today is that it is difficult to run a high-quality program when you're being paid their bottom Medicare, Medi-Cal rates. And unfortunately, a lot of people that are coming out of America's prisons and jails just do not have the right kind of coverage. So again, to me, it's an access issue. I think it's great to do that. I think that would be a wonderful thing to do. But I think one of the things that will solve this problem more than everything else will be providing everyone access to quality health care, no matter who they are. Because if you've got a very small percentage of the population that can afford these cutting-edge treatments and a large percentage of them that can't, I don't see the problem changing.
Well, unfortunately, you bring up a great point. You know, are there any statistics out there? In other words, you know, I went online, I pulled up some statistics in regards to some of the costs of what it's really costing us. And has anybody really sat down and looked at the difference between the two? So in other words, if somebody sat down and said, look, it's going to cost, you know, we're going to need another $700 billion to be able to, you know, to provide what we need to help these people, okay, to provide whatever the combination of drugs and or treatment is necessary, and then be able to come up and say, but look, there's where the money can come from because it's costing us that anyway. But it's doing it in a very negative way, whereas if we can become proactive, the reality would be that we would be able to reduce that number, because the fewer that there are, the number is going to continue to reduce. You know, so I think that we have a problem with focus and looking at things longer term, even when they say that we can't afford it. Would you agree with that?
I do. I think that people right now, most people, they make decisions about what is important right here, right now. What can I do about it? And the right here and right now is that the cost of treating this is staggering. I think you touched on this in a lot of different ways. This isn't just a problem of overprescription of drugs or overconsumption of them, really. It's a problem of education, prevention. It's a problem of acceptance and access to healthcare. Mm-hmm. So I think maybe the reason why some of these studies may not be conducted is because people have feared that the price would be staggering. Now, if you compare that relative to how much it costs us every year to deal with these problems, a comparative study might be something that's good, but what is really going to make that change? A study or action?
Well, yeah, you know? I agree, but I'm saying that you probably need to have the statistics necessary to get the action, you know, so... I mean, it, you know.
I agree. Yeah. I don't know that anyone's done it yet. I think that would be a very ambitious study, and it would take a lot of people and a lot of time. Not to say that it wouldn't be worth it. Of course, it would be, especially to give, you know, an action-based solution, some academic teeth to it. You know, that would be a wonderful thing. But I haven't seen it yet.
Well,
I hope it comes.
Yeah, boy, you and me both. Let's. We've just got a couple minutes before we're going to take a break. Go ahead. Can you walk us through a little bit? And I know there's no such thing as quote a typical patient or a typical client, but take us through sort of how someone, if they're being admitted into inland detox. Take us into a little bit of an idea so that somebody that's out there listening that may go, you know what, that's me, or that's my spouse, or that's my adult child, or whatever. Walk us through something that is somewhat typical.
Of course. Typically, we get a call from one of two parties, either the suffering from addiction or a family. In both cases, oftentimes people don't know exactly what's the first step to take, and they may call a residential rehab that treats people 30, 60, 90 days. If that's the case, then they'll do an assessment with someone on the phone. And it is that person who performs that assessment that will decide, I think you need to go to a detox first, or you don't. Oftentimes, if your drug of abuse is alcohol or benzodiazepines, anti-anxiety medication, or heroin, they'll prescribe that you go to a detox first. Because with severe alcohol withdrawal and severe benzodiazepine withdrawal, you can actually die. With opiate or heroin withdrawal, but you're going to feel like you want to. And one of the discharge criteria that we have for a person going from detox to a residential treatment or rehab that you see on or you think about on TV is that that person can sit and have a discussion for 30 minutes without being agitated, upset, feeling like they want to crawl out of their own skin, you know, because they're withdrawing from substances of abuse. So I think the typical person that comes to us is one that literally can't stop using drugs because they're afraid of the withdrawals. The pain of the withdrawal is so great that they just continue to use. So that is the typical person that comes to us. And our job when we get them is to help them get through that difficult period. And once they're detoxed from us, they stay with us typically 7-10 days. Once they're done with us, we help them get into that 30-60-90-day program.
Okay. Well, you know what? We're going to take a break. And for everybody out there, please stay with us. And when we come back, let's talk a little bit about how long that takes. I know that the time frame has changed over the years. So again, for everybody out there, stay with us. We'll be right back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Founded over 25 years ago to meet the needs of families in crisis, West Shields specializes in resolving adolescent issues that negatively impact the family. From preteen to young adult, we are experienced and qualified to help. We offer solutions which include referrals to a network of top professionals internationally that we work very closely with in the fields of educational consulting, psychology, and psychiatry. Our in-home crisis intervention care program helps to stabilize families and bring effective resolution. We are supported by our licensed investigation company that enables us to offer legal and expert services for locating runaway teens and more. Our therapeutic transportation services help to ensure that adolescents in crisis are safely provided transportation to specialized schools and programs with unmatched experience and success. Simply put, West Shield Adolescent Services is the best solution when your family is facing personal crisis. Call 1-800-899-8585 and let us help you. And we're back. You're listening to Answers for the Family. Our guest today is Kenneth Corioso, and the subject is kicking alcohol and drug addiction. And we're talking a little bit about detox. Now, Kenneth, you were giving a little bit of an explanation about detox. Share with us a little bit about how long that takes these days as opposed to what it used to maybe 15, 20 years ago.
It takes about 7-10 days. It may have taken longer in the past. I think the reason why it may take more tools at both psychologists and psychiatrists and medical doctors' disposal. So it could very well be that a combination of drugs can help people get through that period of time without having the significant side effects. So prior to administering benzodiazepines in a taper form for severe alcohol withdrawal, someone may have had to go through just cold turkey, the pangs of it. And that is very, very scary. It's very, very painful. And it's life-threatening. I think the difference between today and the past is that there's a lot more medical professionals that are knowledgeable about how to taper someone off safely of illicit drugs and alcohol.
And the reason I bring that up is, again, if there's somebody out there and they're listening, they may be believing some old myths. You know, they may be believing the myth of, you know, of many years ago, where it is, the term you use is cold turkey and stuff like that. So, you know, to be able to share, number one, that it is not, that it doesn't take as long as they may have been told by somebody else years ago, and that it is not as painful because of the fact that there are now better ways to do it. There's better ways to medicate. There are better professionals working with them to be able to keep it from being something that they may have been told years ago that, that now scares them.
Sure. Cold turkey is a terrible way to go for almost any drug. But I think one way to help people tremendously detox successfully and get into treatment is for those treatment providers themselves, like detox facilities and medical practitioners and long-term treatment providers who have the same type of treatment philosophy, to collaborate with each other. So, for example, the philosophy of Inland Detox is that we really don't want people leaving our facility a long-term maintenance program. We're actually trying to get people to stop using and not, let's just say, switch one drug for another, heroin for methadone, for example. I've detoxed people from methadone, and I've talked to many people that have been on methadone and had to have detoxed from it, and the universal story that I hear is that detoxing from methadone is worse than detoxing from heroin. So there's a lot to be said for trying to get people clean and sober before they enter rehab. And that's what our goal is. Our goal is to make sure that whoever comes into us, no matter what they're taking, unless medically inadvisable, they leave our program clean and sober with the least amount of medication in their system so that they can go on to their next level of care. And that care provider understands how we've treated them, what our philosophy is, and that their philosophy meshes with ours. So I think the story of success, to get a successful story, a lot of people have to collaborate with each other. And that's not an easy thing to do.
Yeah, and I agree that, you know, you want to stay within the same structure. If you've worked with someone and you have them set up in that structure, I know it's the same thing with dealing with youth. You know, they go into a structure, they learn that structure. Staying consistent with that is very important for their overall success. And we have a question coming in. And again, this one's coming in via email. And again, I want to thank everybody that takes the time to do this. I've had many people, many of which that are teachers, that have said that they, you know, they work in the middle of the day, so they can't listen live. So they'll send in a question on a particular subject. This one comes in saying, my godson, who has an alcohol addiction problem, was recently placed on naltrexone. And he told his parents that it gave him headaches, and he always feels sluggish with little energy. The doctors haven't been very helpful, as they want him to stay on the drug unless the conditions worsen. What is your experience, and if it doesn't improve, are there any alternatives that you would suggest?
It can make you feel sluggish. I've read that it can give you stomach problems, including diarrhea. If that's an issue for him, he can talk to his medical provider. There is an alternative medication called acamprosate. It's used sometimes, so that also has been shown to be effective in curbing the effects of and curbing the cravings for alcohol. So there are other medications you can take. There's also antabuse for alcohol, which makes you very ill if you try and ingest it. So there's things you can do. I think the reason why drugs like antabuse aren't taken anymore is because many people realize that relapse is part of the process of ultimately becoming sober long term. and no one wants to get sick. So mm-hmm. Naltrexone doesn't have as many side effects. If you were to, drink, you're not going to get violently ill. Acamprosate is another potential medication. I would talk to your medical provider about alternatives and ask them if that would be one of them.
Now, do these other ones have the implant capability? That seems to make the most sense to me, something that you don't have to rely on them taking it, every day right. or every week.
Right. That one, as far as in terms of acamprosate, I don't know. But the FDA-approved injection that lasts for 30 days is positive because it requires that you go back to see your provider of care. The pill, you just have to be very diligent. You have to voluntarily take it every single day. And that may not, from my experience, not as effective. So I don't know if acamprosate is something that can be compounded into a pellet that would be fully released over time. That's another question for a doctor or a compounding pharmacist.
Gotcha. And so again, for this person that sent this question in, one of the things that they may want to find out is for their godson, is their godson getting a monthly injection? And if so, maybe an implant pellet may work better or vice versa. So, but again, I agree with you, go back to their physician and have them take a look at it and see what works best. So let's talk about aftercare. That was a huge thing that I was concerned with for many, many years because it appeared as though as an industry there was not a really good aftercare system set up, and which now goes back over 30 years. I've seen, as time has come, we've gotten much, much better in regards to that. So what do you feel is the best way to help people after they have completed their detox?
Sure. That's a really good question. And I think a lot of the answers are going to vary that you'll hear from a lot of professionals. But I think most professionals would agree that length of stay in a program translates to higher and better outcomes, better successful outcomes. So if someone goes to detox, like I said previously, they may be instructed to do so at the 30, 60, 90-day rehab level because that rehab, upon assessment of that particular client, knows that this is an individual that is presenting with all kinds of psychological and or physical problems that render them inappropriate for admission. So they would come to us for 7 to 10 days. Then they would go to rehab, residential, 30 to 90 days. After that, typically speaking, in the best of best worlds, they'd find an outpatient program. They live at home or they live in a new town or city where they found a job, and they go to that outpatient program 1, 2, 3 times a week. They're not residential anymore. They're living at home. They're living their life. When they're done with that outpatient program, maybe they see a therapist for a year, 2 years, maybe the rest of their life, whatever it takes. And every time you step down in a level of treatment from detox, rehab, intensive outpatient therapy with, a one-on-one counselor that you see, whatever, or you just use AA or NA at that mm-hmm. point, I think it's fine. But long-term, this is not something that goes away overnight. It's not something that goes away because you take naltrexone. It's not something that goes away because you go to treatment for 30, 60, 90 days. It's that behavior pattern, your physiology that drives you towards addiction.
Yeah.
That's a long-term solution.
Yeah, and I think you bring up a great point when you talk about, continuing on and possibly for the rest of your life, which doesn't necessarily have to be a bad thing. I know that times have changed so much. I know today there are apps out there. There are groups that are AA or NA related groups or similar types of groups to where they are setting up functions that, you know, as far as, you know, drug and alcohol free functions where people are going out and it becomes an entire community. And now because of apps and worldwide communication, there are people that if they are moving from one area to the other, they can go and the app will introduce them to a group wherever they're going so that they can have those people that they feel comfortable with, those people that are going to be there and maybe see the signs of them starting to slide a little bit and provide the support necessary. So yes, I think you're absolutely right when you bring up the point of, you know, make it a lifestyle, make it something that you're going to take with us the rest of your life. And there's not the stigma that there once was. There isn't this, you know, I have to hide under a rock and I can't share this with anybody. So I think all of those things have helped, and it's provided out there. We just need people like yourself and others out there that are helping to spread the word that it is out there, help is out there. At whatever stage you need, there is somebody there to help.
Absolutely. And by involving yourself in an outpatient program, once you're done with, let's just say, residential rehab, where you may travel to. So for example, our facility treats people from all over the country. They fly to us from every state you can imagine, even out of our country. So the important thing is, to take away from that is there are applications, there are different things that you can access online to find continuing care, but a lot of these outpatient programs that are local, the health providers, the care providers there, they're going to know the network of places for people to go to get to socialize, to network, mm-hmm. to do things that are regular, normal, fun, involve yourself in community. So I think that's one of the reasons why going from detox rehab to outpatient long-term is good, because you're going to reintegrate with people that know these networks very, very well. So if you stop at the level of detox, which is very, very specialized,
mm-hmm.
you're not going to get what you're talking about. You're not going to get to reintegrate with a group of people that understand, that have been through what you've been through. You just won't. So that's why getting people through this continuum of care is very important.
Yeah, I agree. We have an instant message coming across. This one reads, our father is a functional alcoholic. We have been asking him to get treatment for a year or more. He is finally open to the discussion after his doctor said that he has now compromised his liver. We will be listening to the replay of the show this weekend, and I was hoping you might explain how this treatment's and the naltrexone works for those who are in their late 50s, and is it safe for individuals his age who have other physical conditions like his liver?
I think that's a really, really, really good question. And frankly, age, in my opinion, doesn't matter. And the reason why is because you see people from all spectra of age who have done significant damage to their organs. So one of the most important aspects of a quality detox or a quality rehab program is that they go to a medical doctor, they get a full liver and kidney panel, a full blood workup, so that the medical doctor who's overseeing that program understands exactly what's going on with this individual, so that they do not prescribe that could interact with it. So, for example, I think a campersate is something that is metabolized in the kidneys. So if you've got significant kidney problem, medical doctor wouldn't want to give that to someone. And I think the important thing to note is that at any age, have significant problems. So if you're dealing with someone who's in their 50s with liver damage, I think going to a detox or making sure that whatever rehab program this person is going to, they're going to see a doctor who's going to do a full liver and kidney panel and a host of other labs to make sure that the medications that they're prescribed won't interact, you know, negatively. So I think that's really the takeaway. Make sure wherever they send him that quality labs are done, good lab work, and everybody knows what's going on, and you probably won't have these problems.
Well, you know, that question actually reminded me of a situation where we were working with a family, and the father got extremely upset when it was suggested that he go into treatment by his entire family. Now, in those situations, share a little bit in regards to confidentiality. I know that the father was upset with me, and until I explained to him that, you know, the company that he works for has a program set up, and there's complete confidentiality. But share a little bit about that so that the person that's out there listening is thinking, well, if I do that, I'm going to lose my job, or if I do that, you know, everybody's going to know. Share a little bit about that so that they understand that isn't necessarily the case.
Well, first of all, I want to say that I sympathize. I really do. No one who's dealing with these issues wants the public to know, wants their family to know, wants their employer to know. Often for men, their employment is one of their greatest senses of pride and accomplishment.
Sure.
And being outed like that, of course, it's going to anger and frustration because you're devout human, you know? So I think it's important for people to take seriously an intervention and take seriously the confidentiality of that person. Because if you bring to light socially to a lot of different people what's going on with someone who is teetering on going to treatment or not going to treatment, it's most likely going to backfire. So working with a quality interventionist is something that can help. But there are labor laws that protect workers from being fired for seeking treatment. And I think if you call around and you talk to different interventionists or rehabs or detoxes, they can help the family what steps to take to make sure that this person doesn't get fired for doing what they're supposed to do, namely seeking out help when they have a medical problem.
Well, and that is the key right there, is seeking out help. Now, if anybody needs to get in touch with you, if somebody's out there, they're seeking out help, what is the best way for them to get in touch with you or to get in touch with your company?
They can call us at our toll-free number. It's 888-739-8296, or just go to inlanddetox.com.
Okay, you got it. Thank you so much, Kenneth. I appreciate you coming on. It's a huge subject. For anybody out there, if you're driving, if you need to get more information, all of Kenneth's information will be on our website, answersforthefamily.com. Again, Kenneth, thank you so much for sharing.
You're welcome. Thank you very much for having me.
All right. And for everybody out there, please be sure to tune in next Monday when we will be joined by Alan Hamilton, MD, author of Lead with the Heart, Lessons from a Life with Horses. And if you missed or want to share our show with your friends, please visit our archives of past interviews at answersforthefamily.com. You may also subscribe or resubmit your name to download a free copy of the Attitude of Gratitude Journal, your 21-day guide to achieving the quality of thankfulness through self-discovery. And I highly suggest for anybody, if you are starting off the new year, if you're starting off the new month, if you're starting anything in your life, this is a great way to do this. And it's something you can do with your entire family. And the next time you're on Facebook or Twitter, please remember to stop by our page and check out some of our latest posts. If you like them, please like us and continue to spread the word. Thank you for everybody. Be good human beings and be with us again next week on Answers for the Family.
You're listening to Answers for the Family with Alan Cardoza and Matt Polachek, only on LA Talk Radio.